Doug, when he asked me to speak, said I could share from either where we are in our daily walk Bible, and as you many of you know, we're walking through the Bible through the year, or I could just share something that's been on my heart. So I'm going to do the latter, something that's been on my heart. I've processed a lot through this year. We've done some things at Timberline on this topic, but it is actually only 2 weeks ahead of where you are in the daily walk Bible, so you'll get there in a couple weeks, and we're going to be looking at the book of Daniel a little bit. Before I dive into the text itself, I want to give you a picture, an illustration that I'll come back to. It was about 7 years ago, I found myself in a unique situation, a strange scenario for me. I was standing on the edge of this metal door and a number of hundreds of feet over the ground, above the ground, wind flying by, and the guy next to me yelled, "Jump!" And it's not a normal situation to be in. I felt very strange. I had been dreaming about skydiving my whole life, and the opportunity had finally come. And here I am, the edge of the door, a perfectly, you know, what do they say? Jump? Why would you jump out of a perfectly good airplane? Here I am, ready to do it. A good friend of mine in Wisconsin, where I was associate pastor at a church, had gotten two passes to do this skydive jump. And his brother, who he intended to go with, couldn't come, so he asked if I would like to. And it had been my dream for a long time to skydive. So I said, of course. There's a couple different ways you can skydive when you do it for the first time. One is tandem, where you go with somebody who's an experienced skydiver and you're attached to that person. And then they pull the parachute, but you get to free fall for a long ways and you float down together. The other way is you do it by yourself. You don't get the free fall because your parachute, your drawstring or whatever is attached to the airplane. And as you jump out, it pulls the chute for you, and then you get to float by yourself the rest of the way down. The second one is the one that we had the pass to do. And for that one, you have to go through a number of classes, because if something goes wrong, you're by yourself. You've got to figure it out. And so we went down. We woke up early. We went to this kind of old barn-looking building. They set up a TV. And at first, they showed us about an hour and a half to 2 hours of videos of things going wrong. Was not very encouraging. They'd show people spiraling down and, you know, and what do you do if your chute doesn't open, if it gets hooked up, and all that kind of thing. And then we'd practice, and they, you know, they say, okay, you've got your strings, you know, that are holding on, and if you realize it's not doing what it's supposed to do, you know, you need to snap them a few times and see if you can get it to open up. And if that doesn't work, well, you whip them back and forth. You know, if that doesn't work, you snap them some more, and maybe you have to reach up there. If that's not working, you got to make a quick decision to go ahead and deploy your reserve chute, releases the other one, it opens. If that doesn't open, you know, you snap your cords and you whip back and forth, and if by that time it doesn't work, it doesn't really matter anymore because you probably hit the ground. So I'm sitting there, and I'm going through this class, and I'm getting nervous. I know I've seen people skydive before, and I know the parachute rarely doesn't open, but there's a chance. And my wife and my girls are getting ready to drive down to watch their dad jump out of a plane. I'm like, what a horrible, traumatic thing they're going to see as their dad jumps out and whips and pulls and whips and pulls. And, you know, oh, I didn't want to think about it, but I had to do it. I mean, I said I was going to. And so went through the class, learned all the things, put on the jumpsuit, got ready to get into the plane, and it was this, you know, rickety old, looks like a Volkswagen Bug with wings on it. You climb into the door, and then we take off, and you're just sitting around the inside of the plane. There was no seats, and it wasn't like a smooth, you know, ascent. It was, we took right off and then spiraled up in the air, and you could just see the barn getting smaller and smaller down there. I remember sitting there thinking, oh, I hope they make my friend go first. Because if the chute doesn't open for him, there's no way they're going to keep going. There's no way they're going to make me jump. I'm pretty sure they call it a day when that happens. He did go first. The chute opened. So it was my turn. And they said, okay, next. Come on up. They pointed at me. Here I come. Stood next to the edge. And all of these things that I knew here, I believed the chute would hold me. I wouldn't have gotten in the plane if I didn't believe that. I had to decide, do I really have faith that it'll work? I believe it. I do. I believe it. But do I have the faith? Will I have faith to trust that what I believe is true? And at that point, I had an option. I could step back into the plane and say, you know what? I don't think so. I don't need to do this. You know, I don't need this for my identity. I could have told everybody, oh, yeah, I did it. I could have told everybody, no, I didn't need to do it, you know. But I knew that I'd be missing something. I'd wanted to do it for so long. And so up to the edge, looking out, do I really believe? Will I put action to my beliefs, turn them into faith, stepping out and trusting? And I did. And as soon as I stepped out, whoosh, takes off, parachute opened beautifully, didn't have to snap the cords, and floated down. And it was awesome. It was awesome. This idea of faith is so huge throughout Scripture. I mean, over and over again, the Bible mentions faith. Without faith, it says it's impossible to please God. That anything done outside of faith, if it's not of faith, it's sin. Jesus asks, when the Son of Man comes back to earth, will he find faith? I don't think he's saying, will he find, like, faiths? Like, will he find people who believe in God? No, he's saying, will I find faith? People who are stepping in, people who are trusting what they believe to be true in action. And when I look at my life, I know that there's a lot of beliefs that I have a hard time functionally putting into action, into faith. A definition of faith that I love, that I heard a number of years ago, is that faith is the disposition towards an object that allows that object to work on your behalf. Faith, the disposition towards an object, the attitude towards an object that allows that object to work on your behalf, to do something for you. When you came into the church here, into the auditorium, and you sat down, many of you have sat here before. In fact, many of you sat in the exact same seat before. Or every single Sunday. Mine's right over here. It's taken by somebody right now. But you're used to walking in. You see the pew. You probably don't feel, okay, is this strong enough? Is this going to hold me? No, you just plop right on down. You exercised faith. You had a disposition, an attitude towards the pew that allowed the pew to do something for you. Now, you could be sitting there, and I don't know if there's anybody I see right now. You could be sitting there just kind of hovering. You ever do that before? You know, you sit. We used to have to do that in wrestling practice, and you just sit there and you'd hover. And at first, it's okay. And then your knees start shaking. You start sweating, you know. And coaches say, no, keep going, keep going. You're like, oh, stop. You know, I don't see anybody quite like that yet here. I'm not going to speak super long, but if I did, and probably even with the length I'll speak, you wouldn't make it. You wouldn't make it. At some point in time, as you're sitting there hovering over your seat, trying to hold yourself up, you would give up. And you'd fall into your chair. And you'd have faith. The disposition toward the object, the pew, would lift you up and you'd allow it to do something for you instead of trying to do it in your own strength for yourself. The parachute. As I was in that plane, I could have gotten up there and I could have said, you know what? I don't need this thing. Unclipped it, thrown it out, and jumped out. I could have flapped my wings. You know, I could have sucked in as much air as possible. You never think that as a kid? If I sucked in air, would I float a little bit more? You know, or like, what if I jump right before I hit the ground? You know, it doesn't work. You know, I could have tried that. Would I have been showing faith? Yes. I would have been showing a lot of faith. But not in my parachute. It would have been faith in myself. You see, and you guys know this, that faith, the key to faith, the most significant aspect of faith is not how much you have. It's the object of your faith. I could jump out of the plane and I could all have all the faith in the world that if I flap hard enough and if I breathe deep enough, I will float to the ground. But I don't have what it takes to float to the ground. I'm a human being and gravity is strong. The disposition towards an object that allows that object to work on your behalf. The object is what's significant. And so as I jumped out of that plane and the chute was pulled, all of a sudden, whew, it picked me up and I floated down. I did what humanly is impossible by myself because I was trusting in the chute. I love it because Scripture has so many examples of people who had to step out in faith, who had to take what they knew to be true, their beliefs, and we have tons of beliefs, and actually step out and put them into action. And they're challenging, and it's encouraging, because that's often the place we find ourselves stepping back. Daniel is one of my favorite books. It's always has been. Could be because my name is Daniel. And as a kid, when somebody would ask, what's your favorite book? Well, it's Daniel, you know. But it also could be that it's got lions and fiery furnaces and cool dreams and stuff like that. We're going to spend today just looking at chapter 1. And chapter one's an interesting chapter. It doesn't have all the drama of some of the other chapters. It doesn't have any fire, doesn't have any lions, and yet it's foundational, I believe, for the rest of the book. Foundational chapter to understand the rest of the book is Daniel chapter one. We see some clues to that, I believe, by the author. In Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, it basically gives the setting. It tells that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, has come in and has taken Israel away into captivity. That starts the whole book. That's the foundation. That's the setting of the book. And then the end of the first chapter, verse 21, it says, "And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus." That's what happens at the end of the book. So in chapter 1, it kind of gives the bookends to the book. That Israel was taken captive by Babylon, and that eventually King Cyrus comes and reigns. And that's when Israel's sent back to their land. And so the author, I believe, is giving us a clue into the significance of this chapter. And we'll find out and we'll see as we read through it that is significant. It sets the foundation, the stage for everything else that happens. Let's read. Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God." Now just stop and kind of think what's going on here. Here you've got the Jews, God's chosen people. They've been in Israel. They worship this God they call Yahweh, the one true God, the creator God, the great God. And this nation, Babylon's come in and taken over. Wipe them out. Not only wipe them out, but taken them back to Babylon. Not only taken them back to Babylon, but actually destroyed and come in and ransacked the temple of Yahweh. And taken things from the temple of Yahweh, God's things, and taken them to their own God's temples. Can you imagine? As a Jew? As an Israelite? And you're thinking about this God that you worship, this all-powerful God, and all of a sudden you see this huge nation come in, and God doesn't do anything. And they steal God's stuff and put it to worship their own gods. I'm sure that shook some people's faith. Daniel lets us know that that's not really what was going on. Because the whole way through this, he said, "The Lord has done this. The Lord brought Babylon in. The Lord allowed them to do this." God is in control the whole time. Even though the whole time it looks like Babylon is coming in. Verse 3, it says, "The king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians." When we read the Bible, sometimes we get so used to stories that we kind of cruise through them, and we miss significant details. In this section right here, I believe, gives the framework to what's going to happen in the rest of the chapter. And because the chapter is foundational for the book, it really is the framework for what's going to happen in the rest of the book. And it's easy to cruise over. We had, just this last week, a photography week at Timberline where a number of people came up. We had a photographer who came in who knows the Lord and is a great photographer. And we traveled around, you know, Rocky Mountain National Park, taking pictures. And one of the things he said, what makes a great photographer really is the fact that he can observe well. You know, everybody sees the same scene. Everybody sees the same mountain scene. But the one who can observe and pick out the details, pick out something that's unique, that if it's framed in this way, it would look different, that makes a good photographer. I mean, you guys know that. We live here in the mountains. You see the mountains every day. Drive past them. You've been up those mountains. But pretty soon, you kind of just, they're like background. The Bible can become that way. We read it, we know it, and it becomes background. And we have to stop and slow down and observe the details because we often miss the heart of what's going on. So let's look back real quick again at those verses. It says, "Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of the court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility." So he said, "I want you to go around and find out of all these Israelites who've come, I want you to find those who are from royal families, noble people, noble men, young men without any physical defect, handsome." So these are guys who are probably strong, no physical defects. They're handsome. Did you know Daniel was handsome? Did you know that? He was good looking. And he says, I want you to find good-looking young men, royal men, no physical defects. I want you to go and find the best of the best. Showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. Ashpenaz, go out, and out of all these Israelites, I want you to find the best of the best to come and work for me. Go out, find them. Can you imagine, again, being a Jewish, maybe young man, a Jewish boy, and all of a sudden this guy comes up to you, and you've been thinking through life now that you've been taken captive, and you're all these, you know, thoughts, your God has been, you know, the temple's been desecrated, Yahweh's things have been taken into the Babylonian temple, you're in this massive city, larger than anything you've ever seen before, and you're sure you're going to be probably made a slave. You're going to be probably treated harshly. You're going to be probably split up from your family. And just the fear that would just overcome you. And all of a sudden, a man comes up to you and he says, hey, what's your name? And you say, well, my name's Daniel. What family are you from? You tell him your family. Ah, isn't that, didn't you have like royalty in your blood? Yeah, a little ways back, you know. And obviously, I'm reading between the lines. You know, you're pretty handsome. Well, you know, I think so, but, and he starts saying, you know, flex your muscles for me. Oh, that's nice. You know, what's 5 plus 5? 10. Oh, that's good. You know, all of a sudden, you know, this guy's paying a lot of attention to me. Hey, I'm going to select you. I'm going to choose you. I want you to work for the king. I want you to take a special training program. And all of a sudden, out of all the other Israelites who were wondering what's going to happen with their life, you were chosen because you are the best of the best. Taken out of the crowd, brought to a special place. Oh, yes. Wow, no cleaning toilets. I'm going to serve the king. Not only that, but it says, verse 5, the king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. So not only were you the best of the best, but you got the best of the best. The best food, the best wine, probably good housing. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. These guys had it made. And I think it's significant that we know what's going on. Verse 6, among those who were chosen were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. The chief official gave them new names, to Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. What's interesting is the Hebrew names of these guys all have either an El or a Yah in there, representing the God of Israel, Yahweh. Their names have the name of God in there. The new names they were given, the Babylonian names, all have a portion of a Babylonian God's name in there. And so it's more than just they were given new names. It's not like, oh, let's call you something different now that you're in our city. There's something larger taking place. You see, the king wants these guys, these Jews, these smart, wise, best of the best Jews, to become Babylonians, to be assimilated into life of the Babylonians, to become no different than everyone else, and their names would change, and their gods would change, and their life would change, and they would fit in, and they would live the life of a Babylonian. It's challenging to me, because as I think through our world, there's so many pressures to assimilate into life, to become like those around me, to give up the things that I know define me and set me apart as a believer. Because it's easier, smoother, and to just step back and enjoy. These four guys, along with many other, I assume, were basically on the edge of the airplane. They're sitting there, and the setting's been laid. They've been chosen, the best of the best. They've got it together. They can trust in themselves. The object of their faith could be themselves. They had it together. They were smart. They were wise. They were handsome. And they could step back and enjoy life. And I'm sure many did, because we don't hear about any others than these four, really. But they chose not to. I love this. Verse 8, huge turning point in chapter 1. Verse 8, it says, but Daniel. But Daniel resolved in his heart not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Daniel, as he came to this edge and he looked at this void in front of him, which could mean death, to tell this to the chief official. Or he could sit back and just cruise through. and enjoy the luxury of life that he deserves because he's the best of the best. As he's standing there on the edge, and we don't know exactly what it was that he felt would defile him, whether it was the Jewish ceremonial foods that were different, whether it was Daniel's understanding that by eating the king's food, he was partaking in the life of the king. We don't know what it is. But something about the food triggered in Daniel's mind that to do this little thing, seemingly insignificant, was going to put down and move him away from his God. And he said, no. I'd rather trust in God than trust in myself. I'd rather risk it all than step back and enjoy. And so he steps in. He jumps out of the plane. He asks the question, can we eat something different? We know it was a risk because the official who heard him, who he asked, said, you know, basically, if I do this for you, if I give you this, you know, they wanted vegetables and water, that's all. And the official says, if I just give you vegetables and water, you're going to get weak and tired. And the king's going to see and wonder, why are these four guys weaker than everybody else? And he's going to take my head for it. If the king would take the official's head for it, how much more would he take Daniel's life? Just some Jews, we don't need them all. Yeah, it was a risk. And yet Daniel was willing to trust in his God, to move it from a belief in his head to a faith in his life and step out. The first guy didn't seem to say yes, so Daniel talks to somebody else. That guy says, okay, 10 days. We'll let you try it for 10 days, vegetables and water. After 10 days, these four guys are more healthy and strong than anyone else. And they say, okay, we'll keep going. 3 years. Now, I'm not a vegetarian, but I'm pretty sure that 3 years of vegetables and water don't equal really strong, healthy young men. Maybe I'm wrong. God was doing something here. God was doing a miracle in these guys' life as he sustained them with physical energy and strength as they ate this food. Not only that, but God chose to do something even greater. And we see that the rest of the book spins off of this account. Verse 17, to these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. Started here. The rest of the book is about how they lived out their wisdom and their understanding. And most of the book is about the dreams that Daniel interprets. It all started with a small decision. What are you going to eat? Stepping out in faith, risking it all. Another story I love that deals with this is in Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7, Jesus has been traveling around, doing miracles, healing people, teaching. And in Luke chapter 7, we have Jesus, verse 1, coming into a town called Capernaum. It says, verse 1, when Jesus had finished saying all this to the people he was teaching, who were listening, he entered Capernaum, a place he'd been many times before. He'd done miracles there. He'd taught in their synagogue. Jesus enters the city, or this town, Capernaum. Verse 2, it says, there a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was sick and about to die. So you've got this Roman official, this centurion, over 100 men. He was over 100 men. And one of his servants is sick. He's about to die. And this centurion loves his servant. What am I going to do? He's about to die. Verse 3, it says, the centurion heard of Jesus. What do you think he heard? What do you think it was that the centurion heard about Jesus? That he's healing people. Yeah. That there's a guy who can heal your servant. This guy does miracles. He's amazing. He's a Jewish man. And he can heal your servant. Centurion buys into the idea of Jesus being able to heal. The issue he has isn't, can Jesus heal? He believes that. In fact, he sends some people to go find this Jesus. He knows that Jesus can heal, but I think he wonders whether Jesus will heal. His issue wasn't, could Jesus do it? I believe his issue was, would Jesus do it? I mean, he's a Roman. He's a centurion. Why would Jesus, a Jewish religious man, come and heal his servant? And so he comes up with a plan. As far as I can tell, he comes up with a plan. He says, and he sent some elders of the Jews to him. So here's this Roman guard, this centurion, and he's like, how do I get Jesus, a Jewish man, to come and heal my probably Roman servant? Oh, I'll send some Jews. You know, he probably won't listen to me as a Roman, so I'll send some Jews to go talk to this guy to convince him. Oh, wait, even better than just Jews, let me send some Jewish elders. It's all about connections, right? I mean, I've got connections. I know some Jewish elders. If I send them, there's no way Jesus can deny me then, right? And I also think he knew what these elders would say. You see, it says that the Jewish elders went to him, asking him to come to heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, verse 4, they pleaded earnestly with him, saying, this man deserves to have you do this. So these elders knew him. This man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue. Oh, yeah, how do I get Jesus to come heal? I know he can, but I don't know if he will. How do I get Jesus to come heal my servant? I'll send some Jews. No, I'll send some Jewish elders who know how much I've loved the Jewish people, who know my great works, the synagogue I built. And they can go and they can present how great I am and all the great things I've done that make me worthy to have him come and heal my servant. Who is he trusting? Who is he trusting? Now, he believes that Jesus can heal. But his faith, in many ways, is in himself. Here's who I'm presenting myself to be. Come and heal my servant. And we see that in this next section. It's interesting. Verse 6, it says, so Jesus went with them. Jesus didn't call his bluff. He didn't say, hey, I really know who you are. No, Jesus goes with him. Why did Jesus go with him? I'm assuming he goes with him to heal his servant. I'm assuming that's why he's going, is to actually go and heal his servant. But it says he was not far from his house, from the house, when the centurion did something interesting. So here's Jesus, he's coming, and I can imagine the centurion sitting there, you know, and some people tell him, hey, Jesus is coming, and the centurion, I'm reading between the lines, obviously, the centurion's like, yes, he bought it. He's coming. He's going to come and heal my servant. And he could have just stepped back and enjoyed the fact that Jesus was coming because he was a good centurion. He loves the Jews. He's built a synagogue. He could have stepped back and watched it happen. But he knew something. He knew that he wasn't worthy. I don't know what it was that made him think that. Maybe his motives in building the synagogue weren't exactly pure. Maybe his love for the Jews wasn't what maybe everybody thought it was. Maybe it was just the way he'd been living. I don't know what it was, but he found himself in a dilemma. He found himself on the edge of the airplane trying to figure out, do I step back in and enjoy, or do I jump out and risk it all? And he decides to jump. It says he was not far from the house when the centurion sent, who did he send next? Friends. He sent friends, people who knew him, probably Greeks, probably Gentiles. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. I don't deserve it. I don't deserve to have you come under my roof. I know the Jewish leader said I did. I don't. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but say the word, and my servant will be healed. Say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. In other words, he's saying, I believe you can do it. I believe you can heal from a distance. I believe you can heal from up close. But instead of relying on all this stuff that was presented before, instead of making the object of my faith myself, I'm going to throw myself at your mercy and really trust in who you are, that you would heal my servant, regardless of the fact that I'm unworthy. And I love, because it says, verse 9, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. Wouldn't you love Jesus to be amazed at you? Wow. He was amazed at him, and turning to the crowd following him, he said, I tell you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel. He didn't say that way at the beginning when the guy said, hey, I believe Jesus can heal my servant. Will you come? Here's why. He said it when the man said, I don't deserve it. I don't deserve it. But will you heal my servant from a distance? And I believe the faith changed because it went from just a belief in what Jesus can do to a faith in who Jesus is. That song we just sang about Jesus, I am resting. I can't even remember the words, but it basically talks about in the good of what who thou are, of who thou art. I'm resting, I'm trusting, not that you will do X, Y, Z for me. I'm trusting and resting in who you are. I'm throwing myself at your mercy. I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm going to trust in who you are rather than in myself and what I bring to the table. We do it all the time. We get snagged. We get snared. Because we believe all this stuff about God. We believe all this stuff about Jesus, about what he can do for us, what he can do through us. And yet so often we blend in a faith in ourselves. We make ourselves the object of our faith. And somehow we feel like it can blend with our belief in who God is. Someone asks you, you know, to go and share, to speak, to share your testimony. And you start thinking, oh man, I'm going to share in a week from now. I better start, you know, praying a little more. I better start reading my Bible a little more. You know, I better do a few good things this week because, you know, if I really want God to use me, if I don't want to be a fool up there, I need to make sure that I've got a good track record of righteousness. Now, I'm not saying that God doesn't honor obedience. He does. But sometimes our attitude is, if I do enough, if I have it together, then that will, in a sense, buy God's blessing. And that's not what Scripture talks about. Have you ever had somebody ask you to do something? Share with somebody? Maybe somebody asked you to tell about what you believe, and it was not a good week to ask you that? Maybe they ask you to share your testimony, and you're like, you don't know what I did last night. Come back in a week from now. Because I'm not in the right place right now. I shouldn't be doing this because I know what I've been doing. And all of a sudden we slip into this understanding, this mindset that how God uses us is dependent on our own works, our righteousness. Now, of course, we can do things that hinder how God uses us. But we have to be careful that we don't become people who trust in ourselves. These two guys, Daniel, the centurion, found themselves at the edge. And they could choose to step back and enjoy or to step in, risk it all, and trust and faith in Jesus, in God. And it challenges me because we live in a culture, we live in a world that fights faith, that doesn't like faith. And I'm not just talking about faith in the sense of belief in a God. I mean, we live in a culture that doesn't encourage faith. Stepping out, risking it all, potentially falling apart, and trusting in somebody or something else. No, our culture tells us collect, build security around yourself. Make sure you're okay. Make sure you don't trust too much in other people, because if they fail, as was mentioned this morning, then you fail, and you don't want to fail. So trust in yourself. Be a self-made man. Figure it out. Set up security around yourself, financial security. You'll be okay. Self-made man. It's interesting. What's the potential of a self-made man? How much potential does a self-made man have? The potential of man. A self-made man can be as good as man could possibly be. What potential does a God-made man have? God-sized potential. As you release yourself, risk, at least it feels like that from our perspective, yourself to God. And all of a sudden, the potential of what he can do explodes beyond your human potential. I jumped out of the airplane. Do I have what it takes to float to the ground? No. If I want to be a self-made skydiver, I'm going to hit the ground. It's going to be my last jump of my life. But as I learn to trust in the parachute, I can do what I never could do alone because it is greater at making myself float than I am. God is meant to be the driving factor in our life. Many of us live our Christian lives, and I do it all the time, sitting back, our whole list of beliefs in front of us, and we'll proclaim them and we'll talk about them, and we go through the Christian life, and in all honesty, it doesn't look that bad. I mean, from the perspective of everybody else, we're doing it. But I wonder sometimes, do I miss out on the power and the life that God has for me because so much of my life is self-made, man-made? I've been challenging myself. I've been wrestling through this, and I want to challenge you. Are there areas in your life that Jesus is maybe asking you to step out in, to put yourself in the place where you need him? Again, our world tells us to build up security so you need nobody. It's not a bad thing. The Bible talks about saving. The Bible talks about, you know, counting the cost. But when that becomes your God, when that becomes your idol, when it becomes all about saving, we work faith out of a job. There's no need for faith anymore. And we miss out on seeing his glory. So ask the Lord, Lord, is there something, is there any area of my life that you want me to step out in? To get to a place where I'm actually out of control and I don't have what it takes to support myself, to keep myself going. Maybe it's a relationship, a conversation that you know as soon as you call this person, as soon as you sit down for coffee with this person and you start talking, it is going to explode. And you have no idea where it's going to go. That's a scary thing. Are you willing to go there? Typically, we say, well, I'll just send him a text message. You know, I'll just shoot him an email. That's a lot of control there. Are you willing to step out? Have the conversation? Put yourself in a place where you have no other option than to trust the Lord? Maybe it's finances. Is God calling you? He doesn't call all of us there, but is he calling you to step into a place financially where it actually might hurt a little bit, where there's risk involved, where you may end up needing to trust the Lord? Oh, that'd be horrible if we did that as believers, wouldn't it? Well, you actually have to have faith that he's going to provide because you made a decision that's risky, trusting him. So many different areas. Maybe it's talking to a coworker about what you believe, talking to a stranger, sitting on the lift, opening up your mouth and seeing what happens. Do you do it? Because that's where God begins to say, yes, this is a tool ready to be used. I'm excited. Ask the Lord, what is it? It's not the same for everybody. God has specific roles, specific places he wants us to step out in faith. I encourage you to ask that. Many of you don't need the challenge. Many of you don't need the challenge because either intentionally or unintentionally, you're already there. You are at that edge of that plane, moving back to Oregon. You've lost a job. Your family is in shambles. Your kids are going down a bad track. Your parents are, there's a broken relationship with your parents. Your husband, your wife, there's friction. Whatever it might be, many of you are already at that place. You're on the edge. And you have to ask yourself, who do I put my faith in? Who is the object of my faith? Is it I need to get things together, I need to work it all out? Or is it, God, I need you. And I'm going to step in trusting you. I'm not saying you check your brain at the door. He gave us a brain. But you do, you make your decisions, you make your steps with the full knowledge that without him, you're falling to the ground. Yesterday, did you guys see the sunset yesterday? Oh, it was awesome. Just that huge storm, you know, head over the mountains and the sun was just beating down on it. As I was teaching last night, I was being challenged and convicted. And so I got on my way home and the kids were at the rodeo and I said, I just need to spend some time with the Lord. And I saw that cloud and I was like, oh, I'm just going to drive somewhere, take some pictures of it and just watch this thing kind of grow and change colors. And I'm sitting there on a stump and I'm just watching it and thinking, wow, God, you're so powerful. I'm kind of between County Road 5 or whatever it is actually out here. I don't think it's 5, but and Young Life on this dirt road. And I'm sitting there watching and just like blown away by how huge this thing is and how the colors are just going back and forth. And I mean, it's so much taller than any of the mountains. And just like, God, you are so powerful. And then I look down to the side and there in the shade, the shadow of the mountain was Timberline Lodge. Because I'm looking across at it. It's way over there, a mile away. But there it is, small, insignificant compared to that thing. And I felt very clearly the Lord saying, you trust me with that? You say I'm big enough for that? How come you don't think I'm big enough for that? I mean, look how small it is. It's not even in the light. You didn't even notice it until now. That's where you live. You trust me with that, but you don't trust me with the sewage pond? You don't trust me with the finances there? You don't trust me with the relationships there? It's like, oh. I didn't say this. I wouldn't say it, but I knew in my heart what I was saying to the Lord was, yeah, but that's the world of man. I mean, this is the world of nature. This is what you created. But that's the world of man. You're not powerful there. You ever said that? Again, maybe not out loud, but you felt that? Yeah, Lord, I trust you for these huge things. I trust you, you know. Yeah, these guys, this is the world of the Bible. But the world of man, I don't know, Lord. I think I just got to figure things out a little bit more. Or stall a little bit longer. That was challenging to me. Because I realized that so many of my beliefs stay here. And I stand on the edge of the plane. And it's scary. And so often I kind of either stand on the edge for so long or maybe step back a little bit or maybe just tip my toe over the edge. And life goes on. Good things happen. But I wonder, what am I missing? What is it potentially that God wants to do and is longing to do in my life? I know He can, but I'm not sure He will. Not sure He will. Maybe if I get things together enough, if I've got it figured out, if I can present myself well enough, then I'll know He will. One of the things I love about the photography week, and we talk a lot about, is that when you see the beauty in the sky, like the cloud last night, you have to recognize that God makes so many things that are so impractical, that are so extravagant beyond need. And there's no need for the beauty around us, no function to it. And you look at the rest of creation, chipmunks, squirrels, moose. You don't see them sitting around on a stump holding hands and watching the sunset. You don't. I mean, out of all of creation, out of all the created animals, out of all the creatures, no creature does what we do, which is sits and enjoys the beauty God made. He didn't make it for them. He made it for us. Out of all of creation, we are the only ones who surround ourselves with beauty, not for function, not to attract a mate, just because it's beautiful. And as I looked at that cloud and I thought of the power of God and the love of God, why would I question whether He will do what's needed in our lives? Lord, I thank You for who You are. I pray that we would be constantly reminded, especially those of us who live up here in such a beautiful place, to let it be a daily reminder of Your power, of Your goodness, of Your strength, of Your love. Lord, help it to drive us into practical daily life decisions that help us to step off the edge, trusting in You, the object of our faith, the only object of our faith, Lord. And I pray that You would give me and those in here the incredible desire to have You say, that's what I was looking for. Now I can work. Lord, thank You so much for Your grace and Your mercy. In Your name, amen.